People talking bad about the way we have to live here in this country. Harping on wars we fight, griping about the way things ought to be. Tonight I don't mind them switching sides and standing up for things they believe in. When they're running down my countrymen, they're walking on the fighting side of me. Yeah, walking on the fighting side of me. Running down the way of life, I'm fighting men for the dying me. If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song I'm singing go. You're running down my countrymen, you're walking on the fighting side of me. Just how long the rest of us can count on being free. They live on milk and honey, but they preach about some other way of living. When they're running down my country horse, they're walking on the fighting side of me. Yeah, walking on the fighting side of me. Running down the way of life, I'm if you don't love it, leave it. Let this song I'm singing be worn. When you run down my country, man, you're walking on the fighting side of me. Yeah, walking on the fighting side of me. Running down with life, I'm fighting in the fog of dying key. If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song I'm singing be worn. And you run it down my country, man, you walking on the fighting side of me.
When you're running down my country, you're walking down the fighting side of me. And that's the name of this program here on WhiteResistanceRadio.com or AltRightTV.com. You can reach us through either channel. Lots more news and views for our people. And of course, those are the European founding settler people of the Dominion of Canada, the United States of America, the Dominions of Australia and New Zealand, the Republic of South Africa, Rhodesia, and all of you who may be listening this morning back in the European heartland. Well, lots more news and views. Here is a clip from about 30 years ago, a talk given by historian David Irving, a person I know very well, at the Institute for Historical Review conference in California. And he's talking about a prediction made in 1924 by Adolf Hitler. And he's talking about rich Jewish criminals. He predicts that in the future, they will find a refuge in Israel. Of course, this predicted what people like gangster Meyer Lansky and people like publisher, Mossad spy, leftist Robert Maxwell would do, that they would flee to Israel. Anyway, this is a very interesting, very short talk.
Which sources can you rely on for Adolf Hitler's real, don't rely on Mein Kampf, although Mark himself gave me a wonderful quotation from Mein Kampf, which I'm going to impart to you. I didn't believe it. I thought this is too good to be true. Back in 1924, when Mein Kampf was written, Adolf Hitler apparently wrote, well, that's, I'm using the word, I'm saying apparently, well, if you don't know who actually wrote the words, but it's attributed to Adolf Hitler, he said, if the Jews could ever manage to create in Palestine this state of theirs called Israel, let me prophesy what will happen. They will not want to go there themselves, but they will stay in the host countries where they are committing their various crimes as long as they can possibly get away with it. And only then will they take refuge in that state from which it will prove impossible to extradite them. And roughly, is that correct? That was the sense of what he said. And I thought, Adolf Hitler wrote this in 1924. He calls the state Israel. He describes what will happen, and he gets it right. And I checked it, and I put it on my website now. That's the English translation. I put the original German text as well. And every time some fresh tycoon vanishes in one country and surfaces again in Israel, having thrown all the loot out of the window ahead of him, then I always put a little link to this quotation from Adolf. I don't say it approvingly. I just say, well, if anything, yes, somebody else said this once, so this might well be what will happen.
Very interesting connection David Irving makes here. Well, lots more views, news and views for our people. There was a huge rally today, yesterday, in Montreal, and this was an end the lockdown and no mask rally. And this was very, very well attended, and even reported by the CBC. And I'm going to tell you a little bit about it. But I commented when I saw this that this is typical of what is happening right across the country, and consistently. This is not a like a one-time deal. In Toronto, there have been protests going back to late March at the consistent theme, end the lockdown. 2 weeks earlier, the protests began in Vancouver, with led by people like videographer Brian Rue. Same theme. And they've continued every Sunday. I think we're now to the 20th week, will be tomorrow. Since mid-April, every Saturday, and sometimes additionally during the week, protests in Kelowna, British Columbia, led by my good friend Dave Lindsay. I say, and sometimes additional ones, because this week, on Wednesday, his group of people from CLEAR did a sort of a circuit of four media outlets in Kelowna, and it was the same theme that they were and the lockdown. But they were actually calling out the media for their biased reporting or lack of reporting, and those are both important criticisms of the. Of the fake news and false news media. The lack of reporting of the opposition. In fact, Dave had contacted an online media outlet there and had said, well, you carried the pro, you know, basically the government line of pro-lockdown, pro-masks, all that type of stuff. He said, would you give us some say, cover the criticism or the freedom arguments against lockdown, against compulsory masks, and so on. And initially, he had a reporter who said, she'd do it. And then the word came down from higher up, no. And so, in other words, the public, which may think, if they're innocent or naive, that they're getting balanced coverage, that maybe there really is only one side, and that's the government's, because they haven't heard of another side, they are mistaken. They're mistaken because much of the media, in fact, most of the mainstream media, is biased. And when they do give coverage to the freedom point of view, or the critique of the lockdown and the erratic, increasingly totalitarian measures, they're usually dismissed with editorial coverage in the story, and that's very important. Good journalism in a news story provides you objectively with the facts. What happened? Who, what, where, when, why, and so on. In opinion columns and in editorials, yes. That's where the commentary can occur. When it's strictly labeled as commentary, then discerning readers can judge and say, well, this is this guy's opinion, I'll listen to his arguments, and so on. But when commentary is inserted into a news story, it distorts it. For instance, those of us who question the official party line on the Wuhan flu or COVID virus are often dismissed as conspiracy theorists. This is pejorative. Conspiracy theorists have been maligned appear to be a group of people, you know, wearing tinfoil hats with propellers on the top and trying to protect themselves from demon rays and things like that. A complete caricature and distortion. So people who believe in conspiracies come in all shapes and sizes, and there are all sorts of conspiracies. And do I believe in all conspiracy theories I've heard? Absolutely not. And many of those who are critics of the coronavirus scamdemic are not even necessarily saying there's a conspiracy. There are a lot of mistakes, and there may be a power grab, which isn't quite the same thing as a conspiracy. Anyway, so Dave Lindsay and friends went to the Kelowna Courier, which is the daily newspaper in Kelowna, and to an online media outlet, and to the CBC and the CTV television outlets. And that was in the middle of the week. So my point is that people are active in a way I have never seen since the 1960s. And there are so many demonstrations. And I mean freedom demonstrations. Yes, of course, there are Black Lives Matter demonstrations. And so on. But so many freedom demonstrations. Organized by various people. That's one of the really encouraging things I see happening. People who were not active 6 months ago, coming out of the woodworks, eager to help, eager to speak up for freedom, activated, newly turned on to the freedom cause. Anyway, I guess I began with saying that there was a big protest in Montreal today. Thousands of people in the street. Broad spectrum of motivations and ideologies present. Few wore masks. Thousands of demonstrators marched through downtown Montreal Saturday to protest against the Quebec government's mandatory mask regulations. The protesters, the vast majority of whom did not wear masks, carried signs and wore t-shirts indicating a variety of motivations and ideologies in opposition to face coverings. Excuse me. Some demanded freedom, some were critical of the Coalition Avenir Quebec government, Premier François Legault or Public Health Minister Dr. Horacio Arruda, and others espoused various theories about COVID-19 and U.S. politics. I find it illogical, said Nathalie Warren, who traveled from Saint-Jean-sur-Richelieu for the protest. Say we go into a restaurant, we walk in wearing a mask because what, COVID is there? Then we sit down and we can take the masks off because what, the COVID is gone? That's a very good question. Under the government regulations, masks are mandatory in restaurants when clients are moving around because it's harder to maintain a physical distance from others in those instances, provincial health authorities have said. When a client is seated, the client may remove his mask as long as they are 2 meters distance from others. I think that would be their table is 2 meters distant. Quote, I'm not okay with children going to school wearing masks and physical distancing, said Irán Sarmiento. It makes no sense. The children aren't to blame. The population is being abused. So far, the Quebec government has not made masks mandatory for students heading back to school. They are mandatory for most students in Ontario, though. There are frequent spontaneous chants of liberté, liberty or freedom, which is a good chant, as the march wound from the main gates of McGill University on Sherbrooke Street to the CBC Radio Canada building on René Lévesque Boulevard. Montreal police surveyed the event for motorcycles and bicycles. A previous anti-mask protest in the province last month, at previous anti-mask protests in the province over the last month, demonstrators argued the mandatory mask rules are not fair and that the threat of COVID-19 is not as serious as is being reported. On Saturday, some people made a show of embracing each other or exchanging double cheek kisses, which is kind of the French way. It's not a kiss on the lips, but a kiss on the cheeks. In the past, the Quebec government has said people are allowed to protest. On July 27th, isn't that nice? As if people need their permission. On July 27th, responding to protests the previous weekend, Deputy Premier Geneviève Gibault said that there would be consequences if there continue to be incidents where people transgress the rules of public health. It has nothing to do with taking away people's right to protest or express themselves, Gibault said. It's obvious that anybody can protest, but nobody has the right to put anybody else's health in danger. I'm not quite sure what she meant. Maybe the protests have to be limited. Welcome to the police state. Though very, very encouraging, I think. The enthusiasm, and I think I mentioned I was at a protest today in Toronto. This is going back every Friday, Saturday, and theme from the very beginning is we, or at least the promise is, we will continue to be here until the lockdown ends. You know, the we're not going away, and this is not a one-shot deal. And that's one of the big differences I see between what's going on now and what has the past protests on various issues. In the past, there have sometimes been protests on one issue or another, of freedom issues. And they're, like a one-time deal. And there's nothing wrong with that. But sometimes I got the impression that, participants... perhaps naively thought we've done our part, we've won the war, the fact is that any real change is going to take time. And that's something that Doug Christie warned about many years ago. In the 1990s, there was a movement called a detax. And it was in both Canada and the United States making slightly different arguments about the same thing. I won't go into that right now. And Doug Christie warned that much of what they were saying was actually legally incorrect. But what appealed to some of the followers, and I met a lot of them, what appealed to many of them, what might be called a quick fix, and people who basically didn't like to pay taxes, and there's nothing wrong with that, for a whole lot of reasons. We're overtaxed for corruption and foolish policies or anti-white policies. But that having been said, the idea that like a very quick fix could do it, some of the detaxers said, well, you just have to go into court and say that the income tax law is illegal. Yeah, right. Well, that's very interesting, for these and those reasons. That's very interesting, but and I always said, and Doug Christie emphasized this, that only works if you can get a judge to agree with you. Now, it may to the layman seem a brilliant argument. Who never thought of that before? But if you cannot get a judge to say, yeah, you're right, then it doesn't do you much good. And what Doug explained was that people, naive people, I mean, maybe well-meaning people, but naive people, are looking for a quick fix. All I have to do is just say this in court and I don't have to pay taxes. Well, it's unfortunately not that simple. And he said, our opposition to high taxation, and he was a big opponent of them, of that too, it has to be done politically. You're not going to get taxation reduced except through political action. And that's a long haul. And a lot of people are looking for a quick fix and are not prepared to invest the time and the dedication and maybe even the money necessary. And if they are not, then they will not get these changes. Anyway, all of this is by way of saying something's different now. I see the same people Saturday after Saturday at the protests in Toronto, and I see new people. there is a dedication right across the country to the cause of freedom. And there isn't the thought that one big protest is going to do it. A lot of energy was invested in a big freedom and the lockdown protest on Parliament Hill on July 1st, on our Dominion Day. But that was not the end of it. People did not go home and patting themselves on the back saying, we won. We showed them and we can go back to our summer of sports. Well, I can't really do that. Most of the games aren't being played or whatever. But people realized this is only one action in a much longer battle. And that's one of the things I find very, very encouraging. This maturity in the freedom movement. People saying, yes, I came out this Saturday, and if at all possible, I'll be back next Saturday, and the Saturday after, and the Saturday after. Because we know we are in a desperate battle for freedom. And that's what it's all about. It's not about the medicine. It's not about the virus. COVID-19 is a virus. Does it exist? Yeah, I believe it exists. Is it a problem? Yeah, sure it is. But it's not the new Black Death, which in some parts of Europe wiped out a third of the population. It's not. Yes, it will kill. It will kill, unfortunately, the old and weak. The old and weak and weak. So if you are old and already compromised by a number of illnesses, maybe breathing problems, stroke, kidney failure, diabetes, or whatever. Yes, COVID-19 is opportunistic, and would might be able to push your body's defenses beyond their limit and make you very sick and or kill you. Most of the deaths in Canada, 82%, have occurred in extended care homes. Extended care, the average resident has about a 1 year life expectancy, because you don't go into extended care if you're healthy. It's not just a matter of being old. Extended care means you require personal, individual care. You can't really take care of yourself. Well, that means you are seriously ill. And coronavirus, Wuhan flu, or whatever, can overcome your body's weak remaining defenses. It's not good, it's not nice, and yes, we should do everything possible to protect those people in extended care facilities, many of which are being abysmally run right across Canada, the United States, and Europe for years. It's a scandal. The other vulnerable group of people are people of whatever age who have serious medical issues that weaken them. Again, probably respiratory issues. Yes, okay. People in those categories should be protected and should protect themselves and should be careful. Absolutely, I totally agree. But there's no reason to shut down the rest of society. And that's what is being done. And, you know, the echo chamber in the lamestream media, the fake news media, like to say that we hold conspiracy theories. Well, let me just throw out a couple of possibilities. One is that right across the Western world, because of the undue faith of not very bright politicians in the medical establishment, who they thought will get us out of this problem, and that might not be an unreasonable opinion. The politicians got absolutely steamrolled by fine sounding models. We've modeled this, you know, you use computer technology to model where this COVID-19 virus might be going. And the result was, it scared the politicians out of their brains. Scared them into totalitarian measures, in some places more than others. But the problem was, these models, especially one put out by a Professor Neil Ferguson, or Professor Lockdown in Britain, who, interestingly, while he was urging everybody else, or insisting that people stay at home unless they're going briefly shopping or to essential jobs, meanwhile was having his own girlfriend who had coronavirus. She was married, incidentally, over to his place several times in March. In other words, you wonder, does he really believe what he's for imposing on other people? Anyway. So one interpretation is that the politicians panicked on the basis of basically bullshit. Professor Ferguson was predicting 1 to 2 million deaths in the UK, in the United States by the end of April. Well, April came and went, and May came and went, and June came and went, and July came and went, and there've been almost 109,000 deaths, and that's not a good thing, but nowhere near what we were told. In Ontario, our premier, I believe, I remember hearing on TV in late March, ashen-faced, saying that if we do nothing, between 100,000 and 200,000 Ontarians will be dead, I believe he said, by the end of April. If we take very, very strict measures, we might be able to keep it down to 3,500 to 13,000 by the end of April. Well, they took very, very strict measures, and it's, I think we're just a little over 2,000 by the, we are well into August. But the economy is in ruins. People are literally going insane from being locked in or unable to some are so, I mean, so bought the fear story that they're terrified. They're terrified to leave their own place. The other damages caused by the lockdown are incalculable. Anyway, that, I don't think that's a conspiracy theory. I think that's an accurate description of what happened. But if you want a conspiracy theory, and I agree with this, whether this coronavirus scandemic was planned, which I have my doubts, but it may be, but whether it was planned or not, businesses and governments have taken this as an opportunity to institute totalitarian measures, to boss people around, to take away their freedoms. And I think part of this is just natural bullying. You know, hey, you've got power, why not use it? Especially if you've got the sheeples all scared witless that about this coronavirus thing. They'll put up with it. And that's one of the things I find very, very disturbing. I think that is what is happening. anyway, something very, very bad is happening in Australia. And this is something we have got to keep a very close eye on. The beautiful city, the second biggest city in Australia, Melbourne, has become a police state. And with the sort of restrictions that I don't think were even in place, and with some justification, in wartime. You know, in wartime, individual freedoms are limited, food is rationed, all sorts of things, restrictions kick in. But it's not wartime. There isn't an enemy lurking off our shores as there was more or less in the Second World War. Anyway, this is a commentary by Jeffrey Tucker, and I think it's right on the money. Madness in Melbourne, he calls this. Melbourne, that glorious city in the state of Victoria in Australia, granted me some of my the best travel days of my life during two separate trips, each lasting a week. a happy, civilized, highly educated people are here living amidst modern architecture, inspiring bridges, and natural beauty. A place where even the police are kind, and when you ask them for directions, they reply with a smile, and when you say thank you, they say no worries. Now, there are big worries in Melbourne. The Premier of the state of Victoria has imposed a vicious police state without precedent in this country's history. His name is Dan Andrews, a sweet-sounding name that masks the tyrant he's become, and he tweets out pictures of empty streets to brag about what he's achieved in the name of suppressing a virus. Empty streets. An empty city. A city in chains. Australia is the only country in the world that has a law that people can't be mean to each other. Now it is host to one of the world's meanest governments. The catastrophe began with a spring lockdown before there were any cases of COVID-19 and much fewer deaths. The ethos in Australia was one of extreme exclusion and suppression of the virus. Not as bad as New Zealand, but pretty bad. The rest of the world can catch this disease, but Australia would use its geographical isolation and political intelligence to ban the virus. The virus will be in awe and know to stay away forever. It's not a good theory because that's not how viruses work. Still, it seemed to work at first. That's because the virus had yet to arrive. And yes, as a comment, I might say, it made sense to restrict travel into Australia and New Zealand, as we should have done that much earlier in Canada. But anyway, the virus eventually did arrive. Melbourne had set up quarantine hotels for people arriving from abroad or returning from cruises. They would spend 14 days in isolation to purge themselves of possible infection. Then all would be okay. There was a problem. The wily virus escaped. As a result, a nation's pride is being suppressed, having suppressed the virus, turned to panic and full lockdown. Internal borders are sealed. Melbourne has become a living hell, not because of the virus, which is still mild, but because of the unleashing of a hellish police state. There's a billboard in Melbourne. What are you doing? Stay home. A friend summarized the situation for me. Police may now enter anyone's home without a warrant. There's a curfew at 8 p.m. A $1,652 fine if you are caught outside without a valid reason, an amount which is being raised by the day. You can't visit any family or friends. A $200 fine for no mask. Mandatory mask at all times. You can only exercise once per day for up to an hour. Only one person per household per day can leave the house, including for groceries. You can't go more than 3 miles from your home. Weddings are illegal. No gatherings of any size. The army is on the streets fining and arresting people. Since March 21st, a total of 193,749 spot checks are being conducted by police across the state of Victoria, which has a population of about 6.5 million. Protests and activism is illegal. People have been arrested for peaceful gatherings. The media is extremely biased, calls protesters right-wing conspiracy nut jobs, and won't allow discussion of whether these lockdowns are right or not. Several thousand people were placed under house arrest and unable to leave for any reason, with food rations delivered by the army, leading to appalling levels of personal trauma. Australia won't release how many fines have been given out, but an Australian Broadcasting Corporation news report says it's over 5.2 million so far. The streets of Melbourne are empty, even in a city of five plus million people. People are hateful to each other. Everyone is cannibalizing their neighbors, calling police to report any little infraction of the rules on each other, like some socialist hellhole. The Victorian Premier, Daniel Andrews, shows complete and utter disdain for us, constantly blaming us. He blamed children, yes, really, for not taking this seriously enough. Every chance he gets, he tells us that it's our fault the virus is spreading, even though that's what viruses do. They spread. It's not just the Victorian Premier. Australian Prime Minister Scott Morrison left is just as terrible. He encouraged all this, and he was responsible for the first lockdown. There is this dystopian language, from George Orwell's 1984. Billboards everywhere saying, staying apart keeps us together. That's like war is peace or something. Have they gone mad? There's probably more but a point at this. I honestly lost track of all the insanity that's happening. All because 147 people died in the state of Victoria, with a total population of 6.359 million. 147 people died. My guess is more people died of automobile accidents. Almost all of the deaths are people over 70 with comorbidities, same as elsewhere in the world. Comorbidities is a medical term for other illnesses that weaken the body. Lockdown ideology at work. It is a tyranny without limit, at the expense of all human dignity, decency, and rights. The politicians make a desert and call it health. Like everywhere else on the planet, Melbourne will have to reach herd immunity from COVID-19 at some point. Those who deny that are risking not only liberty and health, but civilization itself. Perhaps the other states in Australia will observe the destruction in Victoria and learn to take another path when the virus first arrives in their territory, as it surely will. Lockdowns are not science, they are brutality. I cry for the once great city of Melbourne this day. May there be justice, and may its future political leadership be granted some modicum of decency and wisdom. And my friend down in the state of Idaho, Stan Hess, comments, wake up, folks. Another majority white country, Australia, under anti-white dictatorship. And there is no other way of describing what is happening. It is a dictatorship. Well, this is Paul Fromm, and you're on the fighting side of me here on alt-right TV.com or white resistance radio.com. I'm going to play some songs now by a man who brought the California country and western sound, the sound from Bakersfield, California, to Nashville in the 1960s. A great regular on the old TV program, Hee Haw, Buck Owens.
Love's gonna live.
Spent some time. dream come true. And my heart skips a beat when we walk down the street. I feel a trembling in my knees. And just to know your mind till the end of time makes my heart skip a beat.
Test. track. But darling, before you go, be sure you know how much I love you, and that I'm sorry for the quarrel that we had. If you leave, you're gonna tear my world to pieces. So take it slow, be sure you know before you go. Oh, your wounded pride has blinded your reason, and right now you wanna hurt me if you can. A man is waiting here to take you to the station, and you're leaving with your ticket in your hand. But darling, before you go, be sure you know how much I love you, and that I'm sorry for the quarrel that we had. If you leave, you're gonna tear my world to pieces. So take it slow, be sure you know before you go.